Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. Last week, every news station played the same video. A pillar of smoke rising over the horizon in eastern Ukraine, the burning wreckage of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17. One might even consider this some sort of funeral pyre, a collective memorial held by everyone in the world watching the same video over and over and over. The loss of this commercial airliner with its 298 passengers and crew, almost certainly due to Russian equipment provided to local separatists, marks yet another tragic turn in the crisis in Ukraine. As we discuss this disaster, how it will shape the continuing conflict, and how those involved should proceed, we must keep ourselves honest. There has been extensive pontification on this crisis, and we should make time to reflect on the changes in our views and the resulting lessons we might learn from how wrong, or how right, those past selves were. On March 10th, Sea Control 25, we discussed Ukraine's loss of Crimea to Russia and the potential future for conflict in Ukraine. Today we re-air that podcast as a means to reflect, cast our old thoughts within the context of this new tragedy. Things can unfortunately change a lot in only 4 months. Now, without further ado, we re-air Sea Control 25, the Crimea Crisis.
Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. Today's topic is the Crimean Crisis, and we are joined by three SIMSA contributors, Dave Blair, Robert Rasmussen, and Primet Krajewski. We discuss Ukraine's passive resistance and governance problems, Russia's goal and perspectives, the perception of NATO, and much more. We are available on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. Tell all of your friends about us. Remember to leave a comment and a 5-star rating. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, and anyone who says otherwise will send soldiers into your land, where they will secure all of your government buildings and military facilities. Don't worry, though. It's totally not an invasion. Totally. Now sit back and enjoy the show.
Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. I am, as always, your host, Matt Hipple, and before I start today's show, I've got to tell you, I just read a fantastic book. It's the latest thriller. Let me tell you a little bit about it. Popular uprising in Eastern Europe overthrows a Russian-backed regime, and the ousted president flees. Meanwhile, Moscow decides its interests are sufficient to mount an invasion from inside the country with the forces they already have stationed there, blockading the Navy, taking over bases. I mean, it's incredible. It's got private military contractors. But here's the unfortunate fact, is that it's not a book, it's not a movie, it's not something you can read unless you're reading the news. It's real, and it's what's happening right now with the Crimean crisis in the Ukraine. And that is our podcast for today. I have three fantastic guests from three very different backgrounds. I have, I'm gonna butcher this, even though you told me how to say it. Chemek Krajewski, did I get it?
Yes, that's it. Perfect.
Yes! Okay, got that one. And then two easier ones, Dave Blair and Robert Rasmussen. Rasmussen might be a little difficult, but I've already had that back name beat into my head, so I knew how to pronounce that one. Gentlemen, it's such a pleasure to have you today.
Oh, it's a pleasure for me.
And it's a pleasure as well, Matt.
Yeah, this is awesome.
Perfect. Dave's got the right response. Now, before we start the show, as we always do, it's easy for me to give a bio and background, but it's better for the audience to hear it from the speakers. So we'll go one by one down the line, give about a 2-minute introduction to where you're from, where your ideas are coming from, some of your background, and we will start with, last goes first, Dave Blair. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks, Matt. This is really a fascinating topic. Tragically, a tragic topic as well. So hopefully we'll be able to shed some light on this and help everybody make sense of this in a better way. So, okay, I'm Dave. I'm a PhD student at Georgetown, where I'm studying international relations. I'm an Air Force veteran, although I'm speaking primarily from my role as a PhD candidate at Georgetown. Additionally, I lived in Kharkiv, Ukraine, so I have a number of friends from time working with humanitarian organizations there back in 1999, 2000. So sounds like they're doing a mobilization. It's been kind of interesting hearing their thoughts on it. The perspective that I'm speaking from is somebody with basic military knowledge, but also familiarity with East Ukraine. So.
Perfect. Thanks, Dave. And Rob, if you can give a little lay down of where you're coming from. And get better soon, man. That doesn't sound very good.
Yeah, I'm fighting a cold.
Oh, that's Dave? I can't tell. It's Skype. I can't see anybody. All right, Rob, you're good, so go ahead.
Okay. All right. Well, hi, everybody. I'm Robert Rasmussen. Background I'm kind of speaking from is, I've got kind of a varied background, but for this particular circumstance, I'm speaking from my background in security studies and a little bit of background in military analysis. I've sort of jumped all over the board. I'm more or less a policy analyst. Got a master's degree from Syracuse University in international relations and a certificate of advanced study in security studies. I've interned with National Defense University's Center for Complex Operations and the Department of Geography and Environmental Engineering, as well as the Network Science Center at West Point. And I've also worked as a policy analyst for Homeland Security and Military Affairs for State Senator Bill Larkin in New York State. I'm also a sergeant in the State Guard, so I don't know, maybe a little bit of the NCO experience, but that's not really factoring in. Mostly where my interest into this comes in is from my undergrad, where I've always had a little bit of an interest in Russian and Soviet both military history and military organization. So I've sort of taken a look at the history of what's going on in Ukraine, sort of the historical context and political context, as well as I've been examining the orders of trying to figure out the order of battle and trying to figure out who's where are these people coming from that are in Ukraine. So that's sort of where I'm coming from.
Yeah, and that's also where I'm coming from, because as the editor, I was waiting for that article this week. But that's okay. You're a Syracuse student, and Dave Blair and I, both as guys from Georgetown, understand that you guys fall short of the mark sometimes. So I'm very forgiving. Premek, if you could, last but certainly most, go ahead and give us some of your background.
Okay, I'm Przemek Krajewski, so you spell it perfectly. I'm from Poland. I'm civilian. My background is engineering. I work as a commercial director in a company which is in a construction material business. And my company has extensive operations in Ukraine today, also in Crimea. Small disclosure. So I am a product of Eastern Europe, which means my father was born in Drohobycz, my mother-in-law in Lviv, my grandmother in Vorochta. All these cities are in Western Ukraine. My another grandmother is from Ostrava, which is now Czechia. So, okay, maybe I'm a little biased in this case. So there is a lot of sympathy, of course, towards Ukraine. Okay, as I said, I'm civilian. My adventure with the military was very short. 1 year of military service in conscript army. During the Cold War, I was on the other side.
What should also be noted is that you are a blogger. You have your own blog. You have SimSec.
Yeah.
And it's your name is Verbis Unitas. Is that the correct pronunciation?
In Latin, it's Viribus Unitis.
And that is, I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, in reference to the Austro-Hungarian ship that was accidentally destroyed by the Serbians when they took it over?
That's correct. The context is a little bit broader. I live in a part of Poland which belonged to Austro-Hungaria Empire. It was called Galicia. And in fact, this beautiful ship was Vilnius Unitis. It was a symbol of unity of different nations in Austro-Hungarian Empire. So that's more or less the story.
Perfect. Excellent. All right. Now, you've heard where all of our speakers are coming from. It's a fantastic, very varied panel today. And let's kick it off. So we are talking about the crisis in Crimea. Can be expand it to a bigger understanding, perhaps, of the crisis in the Ukraine, because this is all of a system of systems. It's many things going on all at once. To start off, let's give some of the background, perhaps. So we're looking at this from the angle that Russia has interests, at least from the Western perspective, it is that their naval bases in the Ukraine are of importance enough to invade the country. Now, the issue that I would like to bring up as our lens for looking at this problem is that when the government of Yanukovych was ousted, the government that remained in Kiev said that all treaty agreements with Russia would be respected in regards to Crimea. So what is it that caused this crisis? Is it an issue with the military bases? Is this a broader grab for power by Moscow? Gentlemen, I'm just going to open the floor. Give me your thoughts on where this crisis is stemming from. What's causing all these actions?
Well, who starts?
Anybody, maybe. Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so I will start with a phrase from the article written by Henry Kissinger, that was from Washington Post. And he says, the West must understand that to Russia, Ukraine can never be just a foreign country. So they have also Russians, others saying, in Russian that would be, kura nie ptica, Polsza nie zagranica, which means, chicken is not a bird, Poland is not a foreign country. So I think that we speak about the identity of Russia. What do they think about their state, their position in the today world? Of course, Sevastopol is just a small thing, one puzzle in all this big picture. So it's much broader.
Rob?
I'm definitely going to second Shemek's point. The thing about Ukraine is that up until the 1990s, it's never really been independent. I mean, there were a couple of years during the Russian Civil War where there were some powers that set up an independent state, and there were some versions of like Swiss cheese independence in the territory during World War II. But, you know, for the most part, Ukraine's never been an independent state. And then on top of that, if you look back to the Soviet era when the United Nations was formed, Ukraine and Belarus as Soviet Socialist Republics were founding members of the United Nations. It gave the USSR three votes. And that independence was only a mere formality. I mean, it just gave three votes to Moscow. And I think that with the way that through the majority of the independence of Ukrainian state in the last 20 years, with the bulk of the time being the people in power being ethnic Russians and those close ties with Moscow, Ukraine's really just been seen as an autonomous republic, just like the 20 some odd autonomous republics that are federal subjects of the Russian Federation, and not really independent. The independence is only a formality like it was for the UN. That's sort of been my take on what the broader context of what's going on. Maybe one last thing to throw into it as well is, since the collapse of the Soviet Union and over the last 10 years, the Russian Federation has seen its buffer states that forming its boundary with the West getting smaller and smaller and smaller. And with the prospect of Ukraine joining possibly the European Union or joining NATO, that's literally on Russia's borders. So I think that is all playing into Vladimir Putin's mind.
Now, go ahead, Dave.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I guess to echo the previous two comments, There's an old joke about the Balkans, which says that, the primary export of the region is history because it creates more than enough for its own consumption. I think that definitely applies here, and it's something for policymakers to keep in mind, is that, both Russia and Ukraine are working from a 1,000-year script right now, and we're reading about maybe 5 to 10 years of it. There's a lot being said in symbols. There's a lot being said in the choice of phrases that, on both sides that's trying to jump all through history and trying to make these legitimacy claims as to why things are. So, to the comment about Poland, there's an interesting controversy in the Russian language about how to refer to Ukraine. The word Ukraine comes from, arguably comes from Ukraina, which is on the border. And so, typically, most countries are referred to with the pronoun va, which is like in the, basically. Russians previously had referred to Ukraine as na Ukraina, which basically means on the Ukraine, implicitly meaning on the border of Russia. Whereas Ukrainians, became pretty adamant about saying v Ukraina like it was a normal country name. And so that tension runs back at least 500 years and arguably 1,000 years.
Now, so. a thought maybe that, gentlemen, you could discuss. Baseline assumption here. So we're talking about Russian borders being rolled back. Why does Russia still see NATO as a threat? I mean, maybe that's a juvenile question to ask, but NATO doesn't seem very oriented or, until this invasion of Crimea, concerned with Russia. For the most part, it seems that the EU wants to engage with Russia based on fuel supplies and having a stable economy, and we're dealing with Afghanistan, and we're concerned about instability in Africa, and bringing in new members, and now EU, and by extension NATO, because a lot of NATO members are EU members, are now more concerned about the economy. Why does Russia get up in such a heat about NATO? It's almost like, is it just projection they want NATO to care about them? And again, this is maybe a juvenile question on my part. I'm just not seeing the forest. But it seems like Russia almost forces NATO into positions where NATO has to pay attention to it again.
Well, I would say, again, there's a very good text which is published in the United States Naval Institute News, the primer about the U.S.-Russia relationship. There's an interesting fragment saying that comparing the policy of Yeltsin and Putin. So it's sort of a come back to the old style Russian politics. And this is unfortunately a good example confirming the theory of Professor Merzheimer from his book, Tragedy of Great Power Politics. So it's, and he says in this book that each power is tending towards gaining a relative advantage over the opponent. The problem is that this algorithm has no function stop. So when do you feel that you have enough advantage? So this is unstable situation. So in fact, this is the problem today. Russia feels, let's say, thinks that it's threatened by NATO, which it's not true, but that's the perception. And this perception drives this great country to fight for their position in the world. Then we have a raising problem, an everlasting problem of many small countries, or weaker countries, neighboring big powers. So these countries, let it be Baltics, Poland, Ukraine. Ukraine is a very specific case. To survive, they have to rely on lawful international order, which means on international community. And basically, the battle is about this today.
Premek, maybe you could, let's delve into that a little further, because you have a good insight on this. What is the Eastern European perspective on these events? Specifically, I'd ask you from the angle of NATO members. So there's a lot of talk about, well, Ukraine's not covered under, you know, NATO Article 5. Of course, it's not. It's not a member of NATO. Yes. But many people, myself included, and some of our writers like Felix have argued that this does have an impact on NATO because it's the one step before they get to the door of NATO, if they so choose to keep pushing this envelope. What's the perspective of Eastern European nations like Poland on the position of NATO, on NATO's authority, on how this crisis in Crimea affects its legitimacy and authority?
It's, the impact is quite strong. what I said before, these small countries neighboring the big power have to rely on international order, lawful international order. So we have, at least in Poland, we have, let's say, two organizations, NATO and European Union. And in fact, this year is very specific for us. We could have make some reflections. This year is 25 years when we regained independence. It's 15 years when we joined the NATO. And 10 years when we joined European Union. Well, it's a very specific year.
Oh, that's a depressingly good lineup of anniversaries on just the wrong year. Or maybe maybe Russia remembered, and this is Russia's celebration of what it really regrets.
well, that's a good question. I think that that was the reason why Poland asked for this meeting in NATO, based on paragraph 4, which is consultation about the potential threat. Because, in fact, as you said, Ukraine is not NATO member. But if we will not react, or international community will not react on what's going on in Crimea, then could be the next step. So, then, okay, what will be the next step? And then these bordering countries are worrying a little bit about the long-term consequences for the security in Europe in general. And it could be. And the closest thing, which will be in time closest, will be NATO summit in UK in September, if I remember, where evidently the Eastern European countries will raise the two subjects. So first of all, what does the NATO propose? Mission. And then, okay, that we should stop this disproportion between U.S. Involvement and European involvement in NATO to grow. So we need to stop it. So these are two subjects which will be probably discussed.
Now to cycle it back, I would love to turn this conversation onto the whole aspect of the future of NATO, but we are talking about Crimea. So before I am a bad podcast host and let us go off into the weeds of another topic, let me bring it back to Dave and Rob, back to that topic about Russia seeing NATO as a threat. Is this literally just where they're coming from, or is there something driving them to think of an instance of the Ukraine joining the EU or the Ukraine getting closer to NATO that makes them feel like this is a threat? Because NATO is no longer, I'd say, a natural opponent to Russia until Russia acts in instances like this. So they're almost creating their own self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, Matt, I have to echo a lot of what Przemek was saying. I really do think that Russian government is viewing the world in terms of a realist dynamic. The strong do what they can, the weak suffer what they must. And I would say that not only there's been sort of this fear over the years about NATO and EU rolling closer and closer, and the real fear is based on that realist conception of, hey, wait, this is the combined power of several great powers, and we're just trying to hold back the tide. So with that in mind, the the way that I see these guys playing it out is a matter of opportunism. One of the linchpins that makes NATO work seems to be at least the United States, because it's the largest military contributor, has a huge GDP, can, you know, throw a lot of weight behind getting NATO to do stuff. And there's been an opportunity presented to Russia that if they hold ground, the United States won't be able to influence them, because we've had in the United States we've had declining military budgets. We have a force that's been fighting two front and now one front war for over a decade. I mean, I think at present the United States only has the budget to deploy two brigade combat teams globally. There's almost zero contingency responsibility. So even if the United States alone wanted to intervene in Ukraine, may not necessarily have the forces to do so. And I think that the Russians understand this, and what's going on in Ukraine is about taking the opportunity to show that NATO cannot act. NATO is currently an existential threat, but just that it can act, and maybe in a way that gives Russia some cards to hold in the future in case the way the government's thinking there is on the tangent of, well, what if NATO does become a real threat in the future? So that's sort of where I see this playing out.
Dave, any additional thoughts?
Yeah, I think there's always that discussion inside international relations over whether the sort of isms matter. And ironically enough, this is one place where they actually do, is with Mearsheimer jumping in, there's that classic realist lens, which is clearly what the Russians are operating from, which is any aggregation of power which isn't mine is a threat to me. Because as was said previously, there's no stop function. Interestingly, the thing that creates and has always, well, at least for recent history, created the independence of Eastern Europe has been international law, the international liberal order, the idea that self-determination is important and these sorts of things. And so right now you see on one hand liberalism and the appeal to international law, which Ukraine is making very, very vocally and very often. And then Poland with the Article 4 summit as well. And then you see on the other side, not just realism, not just Russian power, but actually a combination of realism and constructivism. The Russians have been very, very adept in the way that they frame these identity structures. They've been very deliberate in trying to frame Ukraine as East Ukraine versus West Ukraine. The idea of using irredentist populations as, depending on one's perspective, either leverage or obligations abroad. But clearly there's a very, very deliberate Russian frame of Ukraine, which is that it's split down the middle, and that the Russian part of Ukraine would prefer the Russians to the Ukrainians in some form. I think what we're seeing, we understand the realist part of that. We understand Russian power very well. We don't understand the constructivist part of it and the way in which their framing matters intensely on how authorized they are to use that power. And I think they're very aware of that. In terms of Russians' relations to NATO, I mean, this is one of these 20-year at least questions. One of the perspectives that I think has been helpful is the idea that Russia is a Eurasian state and it has a difficult time deciding which of the two that it is. And if you look at cycles through its history, you'll see, you know, one cycle where people are in Moscow and sort of withdrawing into a very specific culture. You'll see another cycle where you have someone like Peter the Great, found St. Petersburg, starts moving towards the West. These cycles seem to go back and forth in Russia, and it's difficult to figure out, difficult to figure out how they reconcile. And I think one of the things we're seeing right now is that there's on some level engagement, but they seem to be stepping back from that and going to sort of more traditional, you know, power on our borders is a threat frame. Yeah, I kick it back to everybody else What do you guys think of that?
If I may add one example, again from Poland, as you probably are aware, Poland intends to build an air defense system or anti-missile system. And this is considered by Russia as a threat. But what this defensive system could be a kind of threat to Russia? The answer is unfortunately simple, because it is an obstacle for Russia to use their power at their will, whenever, wherever they wish. That's the way of thinking.
That's a good example, and this came up when we rolled back some of our missile defense plans and why it seemed so confusing.
Yeah, okay. This is another story, because this phase four, of course, that was very, very politically sensitive, for Russia, very important, for Poland as well. But now we speak about something which is a lower tier, which means this is basically defense against tactical missiles. This is still considered as a threat.
Which gets me back to the point where you talk about it as an obstacle, and that's absolutely what it is. As they look at it as an obstacle, but in a situation where a missile defense shield would be used, we don't have a shield that can stop, the full onslaught of a Russian missile attack. It's impossible. It'd be so many weapons. But they still look at it and say, hey, this is aimed at me, when clearly the tactical capabilities, it's like someone building a gun and a guy in a tank getting worried. Well, fella, that carbine's not going to take out your Panzer. But it's still that focus. And I wanted to bring up the Dave's points about symbolism and taking different views from different parts of history. He's written us an article called The Diplomat and the DeLorean, and I think it's a fantastic article, and it gets more into that, so you'll be seeing that. The problem with this crisis, it's so integral to NATO and EU relations that we're in a constant danger of going and talking about Russia and Europe instead of the Crimea. So I'm going to roll it back slightly. What are Russian aims in the Ukraine? There's worries that Russia will go for a complete flip for the Ukraine to come back into the Russian sphere of influence. Some suggest they're only looking to take a stronghold in the Crimea and take the Crimea. Others suggest that the entire eastern side of Ukraine might fall, but would still result in a schism with a western Ukraine that is not allowed to go back to Europe, but that still has that option. Gentlemen, what are your thoughts as to Russian ends in the Crimea and Ukraine at large?
Well, to be a bad guest and undo half of what you just did there, I'd actually introduce also Georgia. Georgia is an important aspect to this, just because it's a previous example of the Russians using irredentist communities as a justification for intervention. Our friend Rich Gansky actually had a fascinating point on this, where when he cited an article where apparently, according to the article, the Russians were attempting to provoke the Ukrainians into violent action and then trying to use that violent action to justify their own actions. And he described that as organizational learning, because that had been so effective in Georgia, is that the Russians were very effective at sort of at knowing what heartstrings to pluck on and what buttons to press in order to create this Georgian nationalist response. And they use that response to justify a lot of their narrative. It seems like that's being tried right now. And it seems like there's been organizational learning on the part of the Ukrainians, who have been trying to navigate this gray area in this nonviolent space, forcing the Russians to be the ones who escalate, but also making a pretty strong showing. So the thing that reminds me of, I'm sure you guys are familiar with the Ukrainian Air Force colonel who marched his troops back to the base. The thing that I found fascinating about that is that he was able to navigate this nonviolent space very effectively while making a very forceful statement about resistance, yet denying the Russians the ability to use anything he did as a justification for escalation. So Yeah, I think that it's beyond just that Western facing thing. One of the things that's so difficult about this is there's so many frames. But we definitely, I think, need to fold the organizational learning from Georgia into the discussion. So
let me change this question really quickly. We'll come back to Russian aims, but I want to talk about that instance with the Ukrainian Air Force colonel. Is this a path that Russia did not plan for? It seems like, I think in the Ukraine, the phrase is the Russians are asking, why aren't they shooting? And is that exactly what Russia expected? And this new tactic, this nonviolent but very forceful symbolic tactic, is not something that the Russians expected to encounter. And they're not really suited to deal with either.
Matt, I would definitely be inclined to agree with you there. I think that the Russian units that were on the ground, or auxiliary units or paramilitaries, whatever they are, they were completely thrown off guard by these guys marching up. And you could tell from the video that was taken that, you know, you have a squad's worth of soldiers standing there, and the squad leader is, you know, he's telling his guys to charge their weapons, but he just doesn't know what to do. And so all he can do is just throw out threats that he's going to shoot at their knees. And it's not because, and you can tell in the way that even not speaking Russian, you can sort of tell in the way the voice is playing out that, it's sort of a nervous challenge. It's not really like, oh, these are our rules of engagement. This is a, oh man, I don't know what to do here. So I think that tactic's something new. It's definitely something that didn't happen in Georgia. Georgian units, when they were attacked by the Russians, they either attempted to fight and were wiped over, or they ran. It was one or the other. But you know, the Ukrainians is, what those units have been doing have been pretty interesting, as well as just, they've been forming human shields for the symbolic targets that are their installations. I mean, it's not even just that air base. There's other facilities dotting the peninsula. There's the Ukrainian fleet headquarters, a couple of vessels, that are right next to the Russian naval base at Sevastopol, that are currently completely blockaded. And I remember reading a couple of articles saying that they're attempting to starve out these guys now. So it's definitely does not seem like anything anybody prepared for at all.
And to build on that, one of the things I think as policymakers that we should be thinking about is, you know, not to keep harping on historical frames, but it's really interesting to think about what the Berlin airlift was, right? You had a non-kinetic but very sort of forceful encounter where people started thinking about logistics, and people started thinking about the intersection of diplomacy and non-kinetic military force. And it seems like, I guess if to go back to the realist and constructivist lens, Russian power is structural, right? I mean, we know that they've got, you know, that they have this huge preponderance of power in this equation. And so that realist element's there, but where I think a lot of the back and forth is this constructivist stuff, this gray area of who will go where, and you know, like it was just said, that we're looking at these symbolic targets and we're looking at symbolic actions also. Is that, you know, if you look at the military value of targets in the Crimea, that this is, you know, we know what sheer force says in this equation. The interesting thing is that force is constrained by a lot of these questions. And so really the Russians, I think, are seeking to neutralize those constraints through symbolic action. And the Ukrainians are trying to do their own symbolic action back. And frankly, I think very effectively, in order to keep those international law constraints in place and the sort of international opinion constraints in place. So we're not really in this anarchic world where it's just all about power. I mean, the Russians are definitely responding to some of these requirements, and I think the Ukrainians are trying very hard to prohibit them from doing that. One example that comes to mind, and this is coming from a CNN blog post from somebody who's on the ground there, the Russians have been working very hard to maintain this linguistic, this narrative of linguistic separation that basically says that West Ukraine, because they're Ukrainian speaking, is a different group than East Ukraine because they're Russophone. One of the fascinating things that this blog described is that there was actually a day, I believe it was last week, where Lviv, which is in the heart of Ukrainian speaking, sort of strong Ukrainian national identity, West Ukraine, they unilaterally decided to speak Russian for a day just to demonstrate sort of, symbolically that this wasn't about the language. And apparently Donetsk, at least in part, reciprocated, where they started speaking Ukrainian for a day. Donetsk is very far east, very Russophone. So that kind of symbolic discourse is, I think, really fascinating, really powerful, and something that we need to be probably more attuned to than we are. So over.
Hey, Matt, I'll also like to throw in as well that one other thing that sort of challenges dynamic is where the population distribution is. The, a lot of Russian speakers in the East, it's not like it's a homogenous population. A lot of them are actually concentrated in the cities, but the territory around the cities tends to have, a pretty good majority Ukrainian speakers. It just happens to be when you get out to provincial, regional level governments that the total population tends to lean more Russian. So there's that dynamic playing into it. It's like a Swiss cheese linguistic divide.
Interesting. Now, to get back into that, let's talk about two concepts. I want to roll it back into how far will Russia go? And within that construct, what did Russia expect? There's the great example, Rob, you were talking about the blockades. They sank an decommissioned Russian cruiser in a navigational channel. They've got tugs outside of their navy. This seems like a lot of steps for, I mean, no knock on the Ukrainian navy, but did they really assume that the Ukrainian navy would get underway and battle the Black Sea fleet? I mean, what was it that they were expecting, and how far are they going to take this? Dave, I'll start with you.
Yeah, actually, I feel underqualified to speak on that. I think you're the surface ship guy. I mean, like you said, the preponderance of the Russian Black Sea fleet is unbelievably overwhelming. So, I mean, the Ukraine is overmatched on, you know, ground, sea, and air, but I think sea is by far the most, the thing that they're most overmatched on. I have a hard time understanding that unless it's just very deliberate, very direct to advance this idea of overwhelming power, which is supposed to spark all these Ukrainian defections. So I think this is one of the things that was significant about the colonel's resistance in the Crimea, is that of the two narratives that the Russians are advancing very aggressively, we already talked about the divided nation narrative, but there's also a fait accompli narrative in the Crimea that the idea being that Russian power was so overwhelming and Russian support, there was so much structural Russian support that these units would just automatically surrender or switch sides. I mean, switch sides obviously tremendously advances the Russian narrative. And to me, it seems disproportionate, and if it's disproportionate, it seems like it's trying to create this fait accompli, which goes back to why the Ukrainians need to demonstrate, in the pursuit of their own goals, they need to demonstrate, continued resistance without giving the Russians sort of a launch pad for more aggressive action. Over.
Rob, Premek, you guys have any thoughts on how far Russia's going to take this conflict?
A little bit, one comment about this, Navy ships in Sevastopol. I found on Polish internet interesting comment that this is a little bit a symbolic and political issue, which means until there is a Ukrainian flag on these ships, so this could be a problem for Russians in terms of propaganda. it's not so easy to do with ships of war what they do on land with these air bases or whatever. There is the flag of Ukraine. There's no Russian minority. There is no referendum or whatever. These are ships of war with Ukrainian flag. So in Sevastopol. So that could be a problem, not so much military, but a little bit for propaganda. But so why not to allow them to just escape? Maybe this is a simple prevention, which means if this conflict would go hot, really, then still it is a military asset. How far Russia will go? I think that that's a good question. The ideal solution, situation for Russia is come back to the time of President Yanukovych, which means Russia having a strong influence in Ukraine, Ukraine, which is a weak country, easy to manipulate. That would be the ideal. Not so much sizing Ukraine, because that could have a repercussion in the world, maybe too big. But in a situation like this, there is a very strong component of emotion. So situation is difficult to control. So then there is a very good question how far they will, are they ready to move? I don't know. I have no answer.
Does anyone think that the calculus of Russia is, and this is the wrong way to put it, but that this conflict's end is based on NATO or EU action? Some people suggest that it has nothing to do with it. Their calculus is more unstable. But is it that essentially that Russia will stop when they are forced to? Or is this Russia has an end goal and they are going towards it? You kind of get the subtle difference between those two. They'll take as much as they can get, vice, they're going straight for that Crimea, or they're going straight for eastern Ukraine.
Well, Matt, I think that Russia's calculus is completely based on whether NATO would intervene or not. And the areas, I think the way that they're operating is sort of, they've got a sort of a big, medium, small plan. Their small at a minimum is they have to hold Crimea. And the core interest there, the core strategic objective, is gotta be that naval base of Sevastopol, because that's the only warm water port for the Russian Navy. Period. There are no others. So it's a symbol of Russian power. That's really what it is. On top of just the practical end of that being the projection point for the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. So that in mind, there's also the medium and large objectives, which would be to try and get the entire Ukrainian state following Russian power, or potentially taking over eastern Ukraine. So pretty much I would have to say with that is the medium and large plans could involve military forces rolling across, and what really stops the point at which they stop would be definitely where somebody would stop them. That's really what it boils down to. The I think the current stage at Crimea is knowing that this is what the territory that they have to hold. The Russians are testing the water to see how other actors react.
And that gets us into the general mobilization going on in the Ukraine today. To get back to these tactics, and we'll talk a little bit about the leadership in a moment, but to get back to these tactics, in an environment with passive resistance to Russian authority, what could possibly the Russian end game look like? So you have a population that's kind of for you, but not really. They're kind of showing some loyalties to to Western Ukraine, or rather, sorry, to the Ukraine as a whole. You've got military bases that just ignore you. Well, not ignore you, but in a passive aggressive way, just say, I'm sorry, I'm not taking you into account. What does Russia do with that? They don't have a military to destroy, and they don't have the victorious crowds greeting them in every city. So what can they expect to get out of this? What do you think their thinking is now, and where can they go? What's their end game? What can they do in this kind of environment? What should we expect?
Again, very good question. So I think that for the moment, the medium-term goal is to destabilize the whole country. Then you can find, new political solution, which means maybe another Yanukovych. That would be, of course, very tricky after Maidan. But maybe that's the goal. What would be the, solution eventually today for both sides? Because it seems like that, I don't know if this is the right word in English, but in chess. Zbigniew Brzeziński said that the right solution for Ukraine is Finland, which means Ukraine deciding if they want to be part of European Union or not, but not in NATO. So that's the proposal for compromise, which would theoretically protect some Russian interests. The problem is that Russia probably would not trust it. So then we come back to the basic questions. So what Russians want to do? I don't know.
Well, and this comes back to one of the things that was, I think, helpful from Kissinger's article was the idea that Russia and Ukraine are intrinsically linked in these complex ways. And one of the things that I think affects Putin's calculus on this is that if Maidan is successful, if they consolidate legitimate governance of Ukraine, and especially if they deliver on that legitimate governance of Ukraine, if they're able to root out the corruption and create economic growth and create this aspirational liberal democracy, that becomes a tremendous threat to Russia. Especially because the argument about the irredentist populations, the Russian-speaking Ukrainians, well, these people have friends across the border. People are directly observing how each other is living. And if Ukraine, which is seen very much as part of this larger Rus, this larger overall people group, if they are successful in adopting this model, then it becomes a tremendous threat for the control of Belarus. It becomes even a threat internally in terms of consolidating control over Russia with an authoritarian model. Is that if there is a liberal democracy in the larger Rus, which includes Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia, then that's a very difficult problem when you're trying to advance this idea that authoritarian governance is a natural state of things and this is what we need and all of these things. So I think there is, at least in part, it seems like he's responding to, or Putin rather is responding to some of these things. And so part of his objective with the Crimea may be similar to Nagorno-Karabakh or any of these enclave regions, where he wants somewhere where he has an inject into the political structure within the country in a way that he's able to use to destabilize the country and stop them from, stop all of that from happening. I think that if Maidan is able to achieve its goals, it's fantastically destabilizing for him. So I want to kick this back out to everybody because I'm not sure on this. This is an idea I'm toying with, but I think that he wants to hold onto the Krim so that he can consistently threaten Kiev from time to time, that the bases that he would have had the bases under probably any outcome, but he wants land access in a way that's directly threatening to Kiev, so that whenever he wants to, he can escalate, force Kiev to respond, do things like that to mess with their economy, mess with their social stability, and thereby prevent that project from succeeding. Over to everybody. I'm not positive on that, but
really quick, just for our listeners, who may not be hip to all the things going on in Ukraine, Maidan, kind of spelled like Maiden, that's a reference to the popular movement in, Ukraine. So we're starting to mention Maidan a little bit here. So if you're wondering, hey, what is that? Is that a place? No, it is the general term for the popular movement that kicked Yanukovych out of, Kiev. And in Ukrainian, Russian, and a few other languages, I think, Persian too, it means open space or square. So I think a lot of people think, ooh, is it Maiden? The Maiden movement. No, it's not referring to a lady. It's referring to an open square. Now, I could be wrong, and one of you could correct me on that, but I'm pretty sure that's what I've been reading into it the entire time. So, anyways.
Yeah, that's correct.
Let's talk a little bit. Actually, this is a good point. Dave, brought up the issue of leadership about corruption. Let's look back on the Ukraine. They put a new admiral in charge of the Navy. It was Rear Admiral Denis Berezovsky, and he immediately jumped over to the Russians. So I think this was the first Russian, in their mind, win for their takeover of the Ukraine. But Ukraine has had, as with the Orange Revolution, a severe problem with governance. So what is the path forward? Because the last time this happened, and a lot of people forget, this has happened before, the Orange Revolution fell on its own sword. It was infighting, backbiting, a lot of graft and corruption, to the point where it allowed Yanukovych and his goons to come back into office. So if you can imagine such a thing, these were freely elected back into office because of the level of corruption. Now here we are again, at even a more critical moment. What do you see as the path forward for Ukraine? Let's ask the question, is this going to be a successful movement? Can they do what Maidan, can the government, can the politicians, can some of the protest leaders who have been brought into the government, can they do what Maidan is looking for them to do? Because the oligarchs haven't disappeared. You know, the corruption in the general government hasn't disappeared. We're still dealing with the system. We've just cut the head off the beast.
Well, I think, yes, it's possible. Poland is an example that, yes, it's possible. Of course, the way forward will be long, painful, but it's possible. So maybe I would start with it's difficult to explain this environment. So let's say United States, there's this more than 200 years of uninterrupted democracy. Once you've wrote a constitution, you have the same constitution. Okay, with some small changes, but it's the same constitution. And in Ukraine, during the 20 years, we are speaking about the third or fourth constitution. So, of course, they need time to develop some soft skills, which constitute the state, good practices of governance, and so on. For example, how to fight corruption and so on. And it comes from the very difficult, mindset, attitude. When Polish transformation started, one Polish philosopher invented, coined the term Homo Sovieticus. And he meant by this someone who doesn't know what freedom is and how. He doesn't know how to use it. I mean, socialism was a fantastic system. He didn't allow you to live, but he didn't allow you to die. Now, you got your freedom. With freedom comes responsibility. Oh, okay, so, well, what to do with this? You need to learn. And especially in some countries it's difficult. So let's say I can refer to experience of my parents. My parents remember how it was in a free country or independent country. So I heard some stories, let's say. But if that's broken, so your children doesn't know what we are talking about, then you got a problem. You need to start from scratch. So to build your state. And this is something which requires a lot of time, and it's a very painful process.
Now, let me ask a further question on that. So they have to learn. Does this give them the space to learn? Because in this current crisis, one of two things could happen. It could be, to every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction. This could be the crisis that gives the government the motivation necessary to make certain changes. Or in this crisis, disorganization, the loss of bases in Crimea, and political infighting could give them the crisis on which they collapse. What does the group think is more likely? I mean, I'll say this from an outsider's view, again, this is just me reading BBC articles and watching the news. It seems like the government in Kiev has done a admirable job considering the circumstances. So they have a popular movement. They've been able to balance working with them because they don't have a lot of specific leaders. They're organized as a group, but they don't have a formal structure. They've been able to maneuver that environment. They're doing general mobilization. Their army is acting essentially, and when I say army, I'm sorry, I mean military, because this is airmen, this is sailors and soldiers, are acting effectively in the tactical environment they're given in the Crimea. And as we've spoken before, is this the crisis that they need, or is this?
I mean, I think this is what holds in the balance, and I think this is why it's so critically important to see Ukraine from an interagency policy perspective. Too often we try to break down problems into whether they're security problems or economic problems or whatever. And I think that in many ways both Ukraine and Russia themselves are seeing this as a referendum on their preferred vectors of government. So, and part of that is this game will go probably long beyond the resolution of whatever ends up happening with Crimea. So part of this is thinking about development plans, thinking about economic support, these sorts of things. There's some interesting initial signs, and part of this is the sources that I'm getting are biased. They're coming from the Ukrainian side of things. Well, for obvious reasons, I don't have much in the way of friends on the Russian side of this one. But the interesting thing that I'm seeing from that is that there's some promising initial steps. So for instance, obviously the government's completely broke, and they found, I think it was 150 BMWs, if I remember right. They found some of these stores of just luxury goods from the previous administration, and they just up and sold them. They're like, we don't need these. There's a great picture of one of the members of parliament who's central in this movement. And he was waiting to take a coach flight from the Kiev airport, just like everybody else. So they're like, no private jets, no first class travel, all that goes away.
No boats built in backyard ponds. You know, that's, if anyone hasn't seen the different Twitter pictures of the presidential palace, there is a ship built in a tiny pond amongst the many BMWs and aircraft and rare animals. And
it's a pirate ship.
And it's a pirate ship.
It's true.
which is, maybe that was on purpose, but who knows.
You kind of missed the symbolism.
Oh, man. Maybe it was on
or
purpose.
Maybe he got it.
Maybe it was just blatant. Like, I don't even care. When this place goes down, I'm flying a plane to Russia, and I'll get my pay there.
You know, I was going to throw in as well, with sort of this attack on corruption, it's hard to say if the actors that come and take the place of the administration that was just forced out will hold true. But I think it shows an interesting dynamic that I want to say about a third of Yanukovych's party defected from the party. These are ethnic Russians that have come over to the side of the Maidan and the sort of that Maidan coalition in parliament. So I think that with that in mind, you're sort of gonna, you'd see sort of more of a collaborative effort come across, and sort of with that memory already ingrained into the Ukrainian national psyche about pirate ships and zoo animals and collections of BMWs, that they're like, hey, wait, maybe this won't end well for us. And it takes away from, I guess you could say, the legitimacy of Yanukovych now.
Well, and I think that's a core thing, is that all throughout the Cold War, the claim against authoritarianism was good governance, and where you saw authoritarianism do well and where you saw sort of communist-backed leaders do well was in places where you had nominally free and democratic societies, but in actuality there was horrible corruption. The leader was not actually subject to true elections. And in these sorts of places, the communists did remarkably well, because they're like, well, at least authoritarianism is better than what you have right now. And so one thing to keep in mind, as things go on, because, I mean, I expect this to be, regardless of what happens in the Crimea, I expect this to probably be adjudicated with economic growth over the long run. The thing that liberal democracies have to deliver on is good governance and ideally economic growth to go along with that. And it seems like Maidan is taking that charge pretty seriously. But yeah, I think the idea of legitimacy is front and center. Is their legitimacy is based on stability, the authoritarian legitimacy is based on stability, and democratic stability is based on good governance. And if good governance isn't delivered, then things tend to go back towards authoritarianism. Matt, like you were describing with the previous election.
Let's go into some minute, granular details. So for the folks that are listening, if you didn't know, Yanukovych fled to Russia, requested that Russia invade his country and that he was overthrown, and then promptly had a devastating heart attack and is now in critical condition. Let me just throw that out for random speculation. For me, if I was a Eastern European dictator and I just lost my entire country and had to flee, I might have a heart attack. Then again, Russia has this tendency to give people that it doesn't like heart attacks. So to give your thoughts on that, it could be nothing. It could just literally be the health problems of an old man. I'm just throwing it out there. Does anybody think this is part of Russia's plan here to further destabilize the eastern side of the country and have them turn even further towards Russia?
It's tough to say. I would say more likely than not that conspiracy theories that are complex tend to not really be the case, and more times than not, the simplest explanation is the best. I mean, Yanukovych just went from lap of luxury pirate ships to being on the run, getting shot at. At one point, I remember hearing that his convoy was shot at. Fleeing with whatever security detail was willing to go with him, to, you know, losing his country, being stuck in Rostov-on-Don in Rostov Oblast in southwestern Russia, with Russian leaders unwilling to engage him, anything more than just a cursory type of deal. I would say that sort of that abandonment's probably, and just the general stresses, that's a lot for an old guy to take in.
Premek, do you have any thoughts on Russians poisoning people?
I think that, Yanukovych is a lucky guy, because for the moment he's still needed to justify the theory that he is a legal president of Ukraine. So he's now safe.
I think that sounds right. It's one of my friends remarked that strange. It's like reading Pravda again on what happened. But yeah, I tend to go with Occam's razor, but Russia is a land of conspiracies. So those are always fun to theorize about. But whether or not any of them are actually true is
true. Well, you wonder, everyone says Occam's razor, and you're like, what's more simple?
this guy having a heart attack or somebody throwing poison in his drink? I would say both are equally simple at the end of the day. They're not really complicated actions, especially when you're living in Russia. But point taken, it is probably more likely that the poor guy just had a very deserved heart attack. Before we move on to our closing thoughts, one of the things we haven't really discussed, and Premek, you would be the man to talk about here, and probably Dave, you as well, with the folks that you know in the country. So we're in the midst of this crisis. We're talking often in the blogosphere about the economy of Russia and the effect of this crisis on them. What is the effect on the day-to-day lives of people in Ukraine proper? So let's say this is not the Crimea, in overall Ukraine. So people's day-to-day lives. Premek, you have commercial interests in the area. You have people working for you in the area. Dave, you know people in the Ukraine. How is this crisis right now affecting their day-to-day lives and their economy?
Well, in many ways, I can give an example of my customer, who's running a business, selling construction materials. And just because of the price, he was buying from Russia. But now he went to army, that is the mobilization, and he said, well, okay, to avoid schizophrenia, I will not buy from Russia. So automatically, he intends to buy from Poland. So a simple example that it could have an effect on business, on economy. I know another friend, he's Ukrainian from Western Ukraine. His wife is ethnic Russian living in Simferopol. And they have tough discussions at home. So economically today, there is a big problem, first of all, because there is a lack of hard currency. It's extremely difficult to make business in Ukraine. They organize sort of a stock exchange. Who pays more for the hard currency than he gets it? There is a extremely high risk for having debts. So, of course, all these things affect economy negatively. On the other hand, which is surprising, the business is going on.
Dave?
Yeah, I think my experience with it is, when I lived over there, a lot of the friends with the different groups I was working with, I was doing some humanitarian type stuff. And it's interesting because a lot of my friends who are just going to college, they have basically ROTC built into everyone who graduates college, or I believe it's every male who graduates college. So a lot of so for people in the military, the idea of the inactive ready reserve is one of these things that's mostly theoretical but very controversial if it's ever called up, which is once you're out, you're never really all the way out, or you're not all the way out for years and years and years. And so effectively everyone in this space was on a inactive ready reserve, which nobody really thought about. Well, that's now being mobilized. So a lot of my friends who were like really didn't think about military service at all, but were nominally reserve lieutenants and reserve captains in their various forces. I mean, they're getting mobilized, and it's, I don't really know what words are more appropriate to sort of see their internal thinking as they're going, but it on one level, it's familiar to me. It's the kind of things that people say when they're thinking about war and going off to war for the first time. On another level, the magnitude of what they're going into is actually, I think, a little bit hard for me and humbling for me to try to wrap my head around. Just because in our background, we've had such a predominance and such sort of effective technology, and effective teams and effective training that we had different sets of expectations about what war is. And so, this is something I'm still trying to wrap my head around is what it takes for someone in a situation like that to be willfully going and proud to serve, proud to defend their country, against or in a situation like this. So, I unfortunately don't have good words for that, but it's definitely, It seems to be a all-consuming issue for the people that I know over there.
That's a really good. Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, there's a little bit of selection bias because the people that I know are generally affiliated with Western organizations that really are the kind of people who really like Maidan. So there's some bias in there. I can't. It's not a random sample, but. Yeah.
You went over there like a statistician and chose random people in the streets. You're all my friends.
You're my friends, but not that guy.
not that guy. But no, you bring up a really great point. These are people that haven't really engaged, not say haven't really engaged, but are not intimately engaged with that military experience, who are going into a conflict against a massive neighboring power in a conflict that they, if shooting were to go off and in a vacuum, if no one were to come help them, that they may, there is the possibility of defeat. And that's, I think, people in the American military, because we do invest in our military, because we do have such great training, because we do have such great equipment, we're the best military in the world. And part of that is that on a strategic level, not having to face that existential threat. And I think that some people in Ukraine are encountering this very real strategic existential threat, where they see, hey, this might not end well for all of us. Now, I've been remiss before. I said that would be our last point before closing out, but there's also something going on here that we maybe aren't talking about as much, but cyber war. It's happening right now in the Ukraine. It's happened before in Estonia. It happened in Georgia. And here it is again being executed against the Ukrainians. Dave and Rob, maybe Premek, if you have some thoughts. I don't know if it's affected any of your operations in the Ukraine. What are your thoughts on what this shows for the future and how far the Russians have been able to take their cyber operations in the Ukraine? Because from the looks of it, it hasn't had much of effect. I mean, the government, sure, things might be inconvenient, but the government is still functioning. Planes are still taking off. People are mobilizing all around the country. Things haven't fallen apart. People are still living their lives and preparing for this hopefully what is not a battle ahead.
Well, okay, it's evidently that's something new for me as well. I'm just looking at Twitter. Yes, there is a sort of a cyber attack on Ukraine ongoing. About effects, what kind of effect we can expect? There is a discussion now about information dominance in U.S. So if you have this kind of information, so maybe the goal is to paralyze the government. So again, we're coming back to the main goal, to destabilize the country. So maybe that's the tool. No blood, no military force, just a bit of a bunch of computers. So that's all.
Dave?
So,
or Rob, sorry, go ahead, Rob.
So, one thing that strikes me is, well, you know, obviously we are, a lot of us know what happened in Georgia. As forces were moved, as Russian forces were mobilizing, there were a complex series of distributed denial of service attacks, DDoS attacks, that caused a cascading failure of Georgian telecommunication and internet systems, and that, you know, effectively threw the entire country's communications hub into blackout as Russian forces moved in. And I think if I remember correctly reading an article, we hadn't necessarily seen this in Ukraine yet, except for in Crimea a couple of weeks ago. It was when the guys with no insignia on their uniforms, the self-defense groups, started moving into their positions, just appearing almost out of nowhere. Simultaneously, phone lines, internet lines, were cut. And as a result now, you know, a lot of what we catch about what's going on in Crimea is just little snippets and glimpses, from what reporting crews are on the ground, on the peninsula. And, even those people now, that's the only information conduit out of Crimea. that they're even being shut down by some of these self-defense groups, as they're called. So we got sort of that angle playing in. That's sort of the territory Russia's holding. They don't want people outside of it to know what's going on, and they don't want there to be communications between people on mainland and the peninsula and military units on that peninsula too. So they understood the sophisticated telecommunications infrastructure and how to cut it. On the flip side, I do remember reading about this DDoS attack that hit the government in Kyiv this morning, and that one in particular seems to be, in my opinion, a matter of creating an inconvenience, but it's also to send a message that Russian cyber forces can do much, much worse if they want to.
Dave?
Yeah, I guess to build on that, one of the things that I've been thinking about trying to recall my class with Ken Pollack on military analysis is how do we think about the net assessment here? How do we think about how these guys match up? And one of the things that's an interesting difference from Georgia is that Georgia, obviously Russia has by far the preponderance of forces, but it's a different equation than with Georgia. With Ukraine, you're looking at, I mean, low experience, bad maintenance, lots of minuses. But at the end of the day, they were, I mean, you've got a heartland of the Soviet Union force that had a lot of stuff that the Soviets had, like late 90s. Early 90s rather. These things that were frontline units. The thing that we have to ask ourselves is what has happened in the last 20 years? Like what revolutionary changes has happened between the Soviet military of the 1990s, which is essentially what the Ukrainians inherited a fraction of, and the modern Russian military. And so we know that a lot of these platforms have been, obviously the Russians are spending more time on training. The Russians are more experienced. And the Russians have upgraded versions of a lot of similar platforms. So we know that. But what war changing technologies have happened, in the interim? And I think the key is cyber. To some extent, this plays to, the Russian forces were always obsessed about command and control due to a number of doctrinal and ideological reasons. One of the primary challenges for the Soviet military was going to be controlling their own troops. So they already were thinking very intensively about C2 electronic warfare, these sorts of things. So I think cyber is kind of a doctrinal strength, and it cuts along the grain of how they've approached warfare before. One of the questions is how does a early 1990s military respond to something like cyber, if they're able to effectively neutralize all the C2, then that's obviously a game changer. And also cyber's utility in non-kinetic scenarios, which is something that it's just relatively hard to use a tank to do. So I think that's a place where the Russians have made leaps and bounds, and the Ukrainians really, as far as I know, haven't really done much, in that regard. I mean, I don't know anything beyond just CNN, but the question there is how much does it matter? And the second question is what are effective counters to cyber? I think one of the things that if we think about how low-tech adversaries have responded in the past, they've used social networks. And if you actually boil down a lot of the C2 that's part of cyber, it's really actually about person-to-person links. It's just mediated by technology. And so one of the things that would be really interesting, I think it's definitely a liability for the Ukrainians, but it could potentially be a strength if they're able to figure out how to take this grassroots movement and turn it into something that actually reflects command and control so that they become very robust in the face of degrading C2. Whether that can happen or not, no idea. But yeah, there's some interesting things that I think will shape how all of us view cyber if something like that were to happen, and obviously pray that all this is solved without learning those lessons. So
I totally forgot about this, and I would kill myself if I finished the show and I didn't ask. Serbs going into Crimea to support Russia. Any thoughts on that as an escalatory move, as making the situation unstable? They're probably not controlled by the Russians. They're not controlled by the Ukrainian government. And there's several YouTube videos out there of guys doing interviews with these guys coming from Serbia to support the Russians in Crimea. Does anybody have any short thoughts on that before I continue sort of the end run out? But I would be completely remiss if I didn't bring that up. I saw that today. Oh.
I hadn't seen that yet, and that actually just made my eyes go wide. If you just look back to the history of the Yugoslav civil wars and the breakup of Yugoslavia, Serbs don't even have control over Serbs sometimes. So.
Sometimes is stretching.
So the thing is that, you know, the more people you have from diverse backgrounds with multiple groups without unified command and control, you have a recipe for disaster right there, right completely there, where all it takes is just one little spark and all that dry tinder just goes straight up.
Dave?
Yeah, I think it's one of my friends was pointing out some of the terms that the Russians were using inside of Russia today. And, of course, if you haven't seen the anchor resign on air, that's pretty spectacular, and I highly recommend that. But it's interesting the selection of terms that Russia's using to frame the Ukrainians in Russia today is that they keep using these terms neo-Nazis. And so a lot of that is going to there's a policy template or there's at least a framing template that they were using from the former Yugoslavia, which plays well to their sort of vision of when communism was at its height, it was Stalinist communism stopping the Nazi hordes, right? So anytime they can set up that kind of great authoritarian leaders versus Nazi hordes dialectic, then that plays to their advantage. And this is something they did explicitly implicitly probably is more fair, in the former Yugoslavia, is that if you look at the different groups that the Croatians and the Serbians sided with, or the different sort of political formulations out there, that there was the Četniki, which was the basically pro-communist Serbian forces, and the Ustasha, which was the Nazi collaborationist government, which was primarily populated by Croatians, and the Russians use that frame very explicitly in terms of trying to frame that conflict. It's interesting that they're invoking neo-Nazis and trying to describe Maidan. And they're appealing to the idea that there's these far right groups that are part of the coalition. I'm biased, but I think that's a insane framing. But this is one of the things they're trying to link to. They're trying to link to, I think, some of these traditional alliances, at least ideological alliances here. That's terrifying. I'm reminded of that line in Schelling, where Schelling talks about brinksmanship is more effective as you get closer to the edge, because there's the pebbles along the edge. And if there was no uncertainty, then you could walk right up to the edge and it'd be the same as being relatively far from the edge. I think that this situation definitely doesn't need a lot of new pebbles in it, if that makes sense.
Roger, understood. Premek?
Well, I think that, okay, yes, there is a reference to the religion they share, but I believe that in Eastern Ukraine environments, Serbs have no chance to be something important. But it is, of course, a good element for propaganda.
Perfect.
Yeah, I want to echo that. I think that makes more sense than what I said.
Just roll all that back. I'll go.
Yeah, delete all. Yeah.
Well,
give it.
You never know. You never do know. So better, in some cases, better safe than sorry. You don't want to discount them. Gentlemen, we come to the end of our show. Unfortunately, there's so much more we could talk about. I've tried to keep this thing on the rails for our listeners. But before we go, one by one, if each one of you could give us your short thoughts on what is going to be most important for us to watch in the coming weeks on this crisis. Rob, go ahead.
All right. So most important thing to pay attention to in the next few days, I would actually split it between two things. The first is one simple word, and you probably heard me rambling about it or seen me post something rambling about it, and you'll see more in what article I put up later on, put up to you later today. Cossacks. The second is watch what happens with the USS Truxton, which is currently in the Black Sea, interacting with the Russian Black Sea Fleet.
Dave, your thoughts on the most important factor to follow in the next few days, or sorry, next few weeks.
I guess to me, it would be Putin's willingness to take it out. I'm having a hard time wrapping my head around why he's not trying to de-escalate. It seems like this would be in his interest to do so. And I'm thinking that a lot of it has to do with these kind of deep identity questions. So, it seems like there's a way out. I mean, the way out is you have a very long lease on the bases, and probably dial down the number of Russian troops who are there for, but I think it's going to be his ability to signal a willingness to take a way out, because all of the diplomatic efforts hinge on him wanting something that's acceptable to all the different parties. I'm really curious about the role of the United States in this and where we see ourselves, and the coordination dilemmas in the NATO alliance. I think that a lot of this stuff depends on that. I think that we're going to see a lot of interesting internal dynamics, especially between Eastern European members and Germany, how those groups sort out their interests, their economic interests, and also their security interests. So I think in terms of major structural changes, I think it's the internal EU and NATO discussions, that'll change the landscape. The pieces on the landscape, I mean, I think we understand those, more or less. And yeah, let's just hope that this is solved structurally in a way that's with words. So that's all I got.
Premek, your thoughts, most important thing to watch in the next few weeks.
That's true. But we discuss a lot about what Russians can do. I think that we should maybe focus on what Ukrainians can do.
Good.
Speak about Ukraine. So how to support all these processes inside of Ukraine, which are building the state. So we need to help them in the economy. We should focus on elections as soon as possible, to recognize the government and support the new government, which is under the, let's say, attack from Russia, that this is not illegal. So I think I'm not talking about the military support. I think that if we speak about the military support, we should speak about the supporting the military in terms of training, for example. There is a good example. There is a plan of a Polish, Lithuanian, Ukrainian battalion. So, okay, it will probably start next year. So this kind of activities, what we can do now, not exactly in terms of military. So I think that would be important for Ukraine.
Perfect. Perfect. This has been fantastic, incredibly educational. Thank you, three gentlemen, for joining me today. Just so everybody knows, we recorded this on Sunday, just in case the Russians did anything insane, in the next 24 hours to make my podcast completely obsolete. So I do appreciate, you guys joining me here at the last minute. Gentlemen, do you have anything that you'd like to plug? Dave, I've got you covered. You get to plug SimSec, so nothing more from you. Rob, do you have anything in particular that you'd like to plug?
The only thing really to plug right now is that I have an article coming up for SimSec. That's as good of an order of battle analysis as I've been able to gather from open sources.
Perfect, perfect. More SimSec plugs. Primic, you appear on SimSec, but you also have your own blog. Could you give everyone the address to that?
Viribus-unitis.com.pl.
Perfect.
Which is on the SimSec site as well. Okay.
Of course, absolutely.
Unfortunately, it's in Polish.
Well, you never know. Hey, our listenership for C-Control is improving. Oh, last week I noticed that two people from Russia listened to this podcast. Please ask your president to stop being such a jerk. I get to see that data. I was like, ooh, hey, maybe I can reach out to them. Just if two of them. Now they'll probably not listen to the podcast anymore after this episode. Again, this is C-Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. We are available at www.cimsec.org. We are available on Twitter at SimSec, C-I-M-S-E-C. And, of course, I'm available on Twitter at America Hipple. That's me there, too. And, of course, the only thing I've got to plug is, with Rob and Dave, SimSec. All of you, gentlemen, this has been fantastic. It's been a pleasure, and I hope our listeners enjoy this as much as I have. Thank you so much for taking your time out on the weekend.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you for this opportunity.
Thank
you. Yeah, this is awesome. Thanks, Matt.